Hello, everybody who's on the line. Thanks for joining us. This is the CANOE webinar related to the CIHR Healthy Cities Research Initiative funding opportunity. You should all be aware there's a pre-announcement for this grant program aimed at data analysis using existing databases and cohorts. The formal call for the grant has not yet opened. I think they're expecting to do that in July. At which point I believe CIHR will put on another webinar that will address questions related specifically to the grant, how to apply, eligibility, and those sorts of things. So this webinar today is really just to illustrate some of the CANOE data, have an opportunity to ask us questions, and think about creative ways that the CANOE data might be used to in your grant applications. As I mentioned, we are the Canadian Urban Environmental Health Research Consortium. We are in one main way a large data platform, as well as a large group of active environmental epidemiological researchers, as well as environmental specialists. I'm going to talk mostly today about the data platform side of things. So CANOE, as I mentioned, has a focus on outdoor environmental exposures. So when people are thinking about built environments, sometimes that means building characteristics, indoor air, those kinds of things. We're very much on the outdoor urban side of that. So we're thinking about how, you know, the urban form and urban planning and design impact human health. Our data platform has been established to try and go back in time, so to try and create different metrics of interest as far back as we can. That's into the 1980s. So using the same standard data and methods to create a long time series of data that will be very useful for looking at environmental impacts on health. We do have data teams as well that are funded by CANOE to help fill gaps and work on some new metrics. And all of our data for each year is indexed to those annual postal codes. So that makes it really easy to link with health databases, and Danny will talk more about that in his part of the presentation. The data are delivered in CSV format, which is generally widely easy to use in most programs. I just wanted to take a moment to talk about the actual call. It's specific information on the CIHR website that talks about what kinds of studies they're looking for in this call. I've circled a few that I think are relevant. You know, they all are, but these are particularly relevant to studies that might use CANOE data. Certainly looking at the impact on health and health equity of interventions in the physical environment. And also they're, you know, open to funding more data-oriented projects, which is very interesting. Often, you know, this gets left off the plate. But the idea of developing and validating measures for urban physical interventions is quite interesting, and I can see how some of the CANOE data could fall into that use as well. So looking at validating new data products, some of the data we have not been used in health studies before, so there's opportunities for that. There's opportunities, I think, if you have data, you know, to see if it's similar to ours. On the right, I think as well, something to think about with the CANOE databases going back in time. They're annual generally, some are every census year, and a few data sets are actually monthly. I think this affords a big opportunity for people to look at things before and after a policy shift, potentially, you know, over time. There's also opportunities to just look at different cities at the same time. Danny will talk a little bit about residential history. So I think there are also opportunities for studies to look at participants who've moved from one place to another, and that sort of gives you a different idea of what a policy shift might do, as well as participants who have stayed in one place but where changes have occurred. So those are just some ideas about the kinds of studies that the CANOE data support. So I'm going to go through what kind of data we have either coming soon, coming soon or available now. Take about 10 minutes to do that, and then over to Danny for how you access the data and where it's already linked. So our transportation team has been working on some very highly detailed traffic models. They focused on some key cities because of the intensity of the work that's required. These data will be available for distribution in the next 1 to 2 months. We're just working on the metadata for them. Highly resolved traffic volume as well as emissions on all roads within these key cities. Our neighborhood factors team's kind of a grab bag. It's anything that's not really air quality or greenness. So what we have in our neighborhood group is the CanAIL index. This was developed by Nancy Ross and Thomas Herman at McGill. It's essentially, it's in the same realm as a walkability index. It incorporates how many different types of services are nearby, how many street intersections, how much dwelling density, et cetera. So it's a and what they call an active living environment index. We also have nighttime light. That is an emerging risk factor in the EPI literature. We have that annually from 1992 to 2013. And coming soon, our food environment metrics. They'll be based on the StatsCan business registry information. So you can see in the maps, it's hard that we're not really zoomed in, but each of these is a postal code point that you're seeing. So for every postal code over each of these years, we pull the data so it's easy to compare across. Also, we have in just for this most recent 2016, a new data set, access to employment. So a large number of variables based on car versus transit access to jobs. We also include socioeconomic indices, material and social deprivation, as well as the Canadian Marginalization Index. And those are for census years. Going back to 1991. So these are factors that, you know, at a sort of higher level can indicate SES variables for neighborhoods and regions, which may be useful to control for. We have quite a bit of air quality data. We have four key sets representing fine particulates. We also have nitrogen dioxide, sulfur dioxide, and ozone. The time series on those varies a bit, with nitrogen dioxide having the longest, 1984 up to 2012. But we have pretty good coverage across the board from, you know, 2000 to 2015 or so. One of the things to notice about the CANU data is that the data are indexed to postal codes, but that doesn't necessarily mean the base data have that fine of a resolution. The fine particulates is 1 kilometer. That means that all of the postal codes within a 1 kilometer square would get the same value from the air quality model. The nitrogen dioxide model is actually modeled at the postal code. So every postal code has a unique, potentially a unique value based on the predictors around it. Sulfur dioxide is a 30 kilometer resolution. So again, all of the postal codes that fall within a 30 kilometer block in the model would have the same value. And ozone is between 21 and 10 kilometers. Our greenness team is kind of expanding into green, blue, and natural spaces. Right now, we have a very large amount of what we call greenness, which is essentially measured from satellites as this normalized different vegetation index. It's been used in a lot of the literature over the last decade or so because it's easily available around the globe. It comes at a 30 meter resolution, 250 or 1 kilometers. We have a number of different metrics, so not just annual average, but we have, you know, the maximum amount, growing season averages, etc. Nice long time series there. We've also been using some machine learning in Google Earth Engine to look at the Landsat satellite data, that's the 30-meter resolution, and classifying types of greenness and blue within 1 kilometer of each postal code centroid. So we have those for census years. So that's a fair bit of information in that data set. Climate and weather, we often skip over this one because there's an awful lot in there. I just want to take a few minutes to sort of walk through it a little more carefully than we usually do. What we have for weather and climate comes essentially from NRCan, so Natural Resources Canada. So for all of the different monitoring stations for weather across Canada, they pull those data together and then they have an interpolating model that creates sort of an estimate, you know, across all of Canada of all the various different kinds of weather metrics. And we use those as input for modeling as well. So we sent all the postal codes for 1985 through 2015, and they ran their interpolation models specifically for the postal codes. So although you don't see a lot of variation right at the neighborhoods, so for example, you know, annual rainfall from one neighborhood to another probably doesn't, you know, vary too much. Each spot does have its own unique value, and you can certainly go city to city, region to region, and these kinds of things might be important for a variety of things. I'll talk about that in a moment. Based on those data, the weather and climate team has created a water balance metric, and we've also used Google Earth Engine to come up with a local climate zone classification. So these data are meant to be, well, they sort of originate from global climate modelers, but what it does is really characterize urban form well, and I'm going to go through these a little more carefully so we can see what's in there. So the interpolated weather data actually has 35 unique variables that you could use one of or many of, whichever you're interested in, but essentially the basic temperature kinds of things, also heat events and cool events based on a variety of different thresholds. So, you know, number of days above the normal 95th maximum percentile, those kinds of things. Everything is documented on our website, and Danny will talk about that as well. There are some rain and snow, so how much rain, how much snow, number of frost-free days, a wealth of information there. The water balance metrics, there are 21 variables in this data set. Again, a couple of basic temperature metrics and some precipitation metrics. But I think what's interesting is more around the water balance. So how many days are snow actually on the ground? Where do we have surplus of moisture, which could indicate flooding? Where do we have deficits, which could be indicating droughts? This relative index of dryness and wetness. And we think there's going to be a lot of application of these data when thinking about vegetation growth, so greenness, you know, when is greenness happening? Is it different from year to year over seasons? This impacts allergen loads and molds potentially. If we think about snow and rain, that impacts people's opportunities for physical activity. You know, so there's a lot of ways to connect these data. And obviously, as we're thinking about heat events, just looking at are people, you know, in urban areas experience more heat events, and how have those affected people over time? The local climate zone data, as I said, kind of integrates the built environment all into one spot. So, for example, a local climate zone 1 is really a very dense urban area with a lot of pavement, whereas a local climate zone 9 is open farm, and these all have different impacts on people in terms of, you know, the heat they experience, the noise they experience, their exposure to green and blue. And so this is a fairly new, well, like I said, it's not a new data set to climate modelers, but it's a new data set for health researchers. And so we've got people starting to see how this kind of information might relate to health and capture some of the mechanisms potentially that are related to health outcomes. So I'm going to turn it over to Danny there. And again, please do chat, use the chat function, and we'll get to that at the end. Over to you, Danny.
Thanks, Eleanor. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So in this second part of the presentation, I'll briefly go over how to access and use environmental exposure data sets that Eleanor has just presented. I'll also give an overview of health data custodians with pre-linked CNU data ready for dissemination, and give an outline of a project we have undertaken in partnership with Statistics Canada to create historical environmental exposure profiles for Canadian cohorts. Next slide.
Oh. Sorry, there's a bit of a lag, I think, Danny. Have you got it?
Okay. Yeah, I see it now. Yeah.
Okay.
So first, and as Eleanor already mentioned, all CNU exposure data are indexed to the 6-digit postal code and provided as comma separated values or CSV files. This allows for easy import and merging with health data sets using the residential postal code as the unique linkage field. CNU data sets are also accompanied by comprehensive data documentation, which you'll find on our website at cnu.ca/data. Metadata documents give technical information about who produced the data, how it was developed, the time and spatial resolution, data dictionary providing variable names, coding and descriptions, conditions of use whenever they are present, as well as information on dataset versioning. Next slide. So CNU data can either be accessed directly from us, so from CNU via one of the health data custodians holding pre-linked CNU data sets, which I'll be presenting in a minute. Use of CNU data may require specific citations and acknowledgments, which are described in our metadata documents. And to ensure that these conditions are fulfilled, all data users need to sign CNU's data sharing and use agreement, which is available on our website or which is provided by one of the health data custodians providing pre-linked data. Of note, at least one team member applying for access to CNU data must be affiliated with a Canadian academic institution, and this condition is due to the license requirements of the proprietary postal code files to which CNU exposures are indexed. So these files are developed by DMTI Spatial Inc., which is a private company that gives free access to the postal code files to academics for teaching, as well as academic research and public publishing. So this this agreement between DMTI and Canadian universities is called the SMART agreement. So over the past 2 years, CNU has been working with Canadian cohort studies and administrative health data holders to pre-link environmental exposures in order to facilitate and encourage research on the environmental determinants of health. As I mentioned, all CNU data sets are indexed to a 6-digit postal code, allowing health data holders to easily integrate exposures into their own database using the residential postal code of individuals and the years of assessment as linkage fields. So far, Canada's largest adult, aging, and birth cohorts, as well as two administrative health data holders, the Manitoba Centre for Health Policy and Population Data BC, have pre-linked CNU data ready to be accessed by researchers. We're also in discussions with a number of other health databases from across Canada interested in taking in CNU exposures, and these include the Institute for Clinical Evaluative Sciences in Ontario and Statistics Canada's Research Data Centres. I'll just note that while these and other health data custodians do not yet have pre-linked data, Researchers can still request data directly from us, so from CNU, and then ask that the data sets be linked on a project specific basis. Yeah. Next slide. So this slide gives an overview of the health databases that hold and distribute pre-linked CNU exposure variables. So first, the Canadian Partnership for Tomorrow Project, or CPTP, brings together over 300,000 individuals participating in five regional cohorts from across Canada. These are Alberta's Tomorrow Project, the Atlantic Partnership for Tomorrow's Health, or Atlantic PATH, the BC Generations Project, Cartagène in Quebec, and the Ontario Health Study. CNU data can be accessed via the CPTP data portal at portal.partnershipfortomorrow.ca or via one of the five regional cohorts' website. Exposure variables are linked to CPTP baseline assessment. Secondly, CNU data is pre-linked to the baseline data of the Canadian Longitudinal Study on Aging, or CLSA, and this cohort includes 50,000 individuals from across Canada aged 45 to 85 years, and more information on CLSA data, as well as their access procedures, can be found on their website at clsa-elcv.ca. The Child Study also holds and distributes CNU data. This cohort is made up of 3,500 mother-child pairs followed from pregnancy to age five with prospective characterization of diverse exposures and health outcomes during this period. More information is available at childstudy.ca. And I'll note that one of the three funding streams of this funding call is in reproductive, maternal, child and youth health. So the child study will be relevant for that funding stream. Lastly, two administrative health data custodians have also taken in CNU data, as I already mentioned, and they distribute the exposures along with their own data sets. And these are the Manitoba Centre for Health Policy and Population Data BC. Just a note that not all data custodians have necessarily taken in all available CNU exposure variables. And we'll be updating our website at CNU.ca/data shortly with a list of exposure data sets available via each of the health data custodians. Next slide. So I'll finish my presentation with a couple slides about an initiative we are conducting in partnership with Statistics Canada that will construct the residential history of individuals in Canadian cohort studies. So firstly, though, I'll give a bit of background on why residential history is important for environmental health research. So as we've seen, environmental exposures are estimated geographically and linked to health records using residential postal codes. Often we're limited to using the current residential address, and this then implies that the individual spends and has spent all their time at that location. This is a pretty accurate estimation of exposure if we're looking at acute health outcomes associated with short exposures. So for example, exposure to forest fire smoke for 1 or 2 days. And it's not bad either if we're looking at in utero exposures and birth outcomes, although we do start getting some exposure errors if participants actually move to a different location during their pregnancy. And it might even be okay for looking at chronic diseases if the individuals have not moved for many years, but we can get some really large exposure errors if they have moved. So for example, moving from a dense downtown area with high air pollution and noise level to the countryside, or from a large city to a smaller town. Next slide. So CNU has partnered with Statistics Canada's Social Data Linkage Environment, or SDLE, program and the Canadian Partnership for Tomorrow to build the residential history of participants in regional CPTP cohorts. The SDLE is essentially a database containing personal identifiers and addresses reported on various federal documents, such as annual tax returns. However, it's important to note that the SDLE does not hold actual tax returns or other documents. Only the personal identifiers and addresses are kept in the database. So under this initiative, participating CPTP cohorts first send linkage fields such as names, birth dates, and sex to the SDLE. And in parallel, we at CANU send the SDLE postal code specific environmental exposures dating back to the 1980s. The SDLE staff then create the residential history of cohort participants using federal records and attach yearly exposure estimates to each record. Finally, the SDLE sends unique record IDs, so the study subject IDs, and yearly exposure estimates from the 1980s to today back to the CPTP cohorts. So far, the BC Generations Project and the Ontario Health Study have obtained historical environmental exposure profiles of study participants through this initiative. And historical environmental exposure profiles for the Alberta Tomorrow Project, as well as the Atlantic Path cohorts, are also expected to be completed in the coming fiscal year. And I think, well, that's it for my presentation. If you want to ask questions, you can use the chat function, which is in the upper right corner of your screen. So you can use that to just type in your question. We already have one. And it's, I may have misread, did slide 4 note noise pollution? Is that captured as part of the data platform?
Thanks, Danny. Yes, the noise team is working on creating detailed noise models for key Canadian cities. That work is underway. I don't think we'll see the full models probably for 6 months, maybe 12, so it might not come in time for grants within this. It might. If you are interested in noise, please do contact us separately and I can get some better information on that. What's happening right now is they're out actually doing field monitoring across Ontario to develop some highly detailed modeling there, and depending on those results, we'll be able to potentially expand that as well. So yes, noise is something that will come.
So we have another question that just came in. Thanks for the presentation. Will these slides be posted on your website to access at a later time?
Yeah, we'll post the slides with a separate audio file so you can have both of those within the next few days.
So I think most people are probably muted. If you want to ask a question, again, you can use the chat function, which is in the upper right-hand corner of the Uber conference screen.
And we don't have that many participants, I think, at this point, since most, I think, were on the CHR webinar yesterday. But you can star to unmute your phone if you want to speak verbally. So we'll wait a few minutes, and if we have no questions within a minute or two, we'll wrap things up. Certainly do encourage you to contact us directly to talk more about your ideas, the feasibility of what you want to do. You can request data from CANU anytime, really. So I think in past calls for this, researchers often request the data they believe they're interested in so they can get a look at it, see what kind of variation is in there, and that can help inform an application as well. So it's not a bad idea to put in a data request so you can actually get your hands on the data ahead of writing your grant application.
So we have two more questions. First one is, when data sets are indexed by postal code, does historic data sets carry current postal codes or historic postal code? How does the fluidity of postal code over time affect linkages?
It does. It is a good question. I think if when using postal codes, for those of you who haven't done it much, there's a few things to think about. The first is that they're pretty accurate spatially in dense areas, dense urban areas. They get very much less accurate in rural areas. So, for example, you know, out in a rural area, it might be a general delivery. Everybody who lives in that town will all have the same XY location, and so the exposure might be quite inaccurate if you're looking at the high resolution data. If you were looking at, say, that air quality data with a 30 kilometer pixel, it's probably okay, but that's something to consider. We do have a postal code file. It comes with attributes that can help you understand that part of the equation. So it will tell you how the postal code was assigned its location, if it's what's called a multi-street postal code, so that it means that it covers residences that are on more than one street. And you'll see that as you get further and further out of highly developed areas. The question is really about another technical piece where over time postal codes are born and retired, so it's not always the same postal codes from year to year, and they can even move the postal code a bit and make it more accurate. This is almost completely intractable for us to handle, because if a postal code moves a location 20 years ago, it might not be in the same location now. The data aren't registered, so we have staked 2015 as our base year, and we use the locations as of that date. And as new postal codes come on, they will have the location they're given at the date they're born. So in that regard, there will definitely be some variation, especially in rural areas. In urban areas, our analysis suggests these are changes on the order of sub-meter to 10 meters, so we believe that's okay. All you want to know about postal codes and more, but it is is definitely something that we should think about carefully.
So there's another one. How often is data updated and or added?
We've been working hard over the last few years just to pull together a lot of the existing data, and that's mostly what you see. Over the next few years, our data teams will certainly be adding more metrics in there, the noise, the transportation. We're working on some new greenness and so on. We take in data, again, existing data as best we can. We've just processed some UV data, which we could start making available once it gets documented. But it's kind of I wouldn't say we have a regular program of, you know, that we can estimate there'll be 10 new data sets per year. Data are updated when we get new postal code files. Right now we have 2016 and 2017. We don't have 2018. Some of the data sets, like the satellite-based ones, we can move forward, but we'll probably do a big update in the spring to try and get everything up to current, as close to current year as we can, for as many of the data sets. But don't expect we're going to have a large variety of new data sets in the next 6 to 12 months, so. Other
so
than those I've mentioned, the food environment and the transportation and so on.
There's a question on pollen, and so it says, is there any data on aeroallergens available through canoe or pollen counts?
Unfortunately, no. Aeroallergen is a company that does the monitoring, and they do provide pollen data for academic use for a discounted fee, but that's on a project-by-project basis. So you would have to contact them directly for pollen data.
So again, if anyone has any additional questions, you can use the chat function or press ** to unmute yourself.
Well, if there's no more, I think that we might as well wrap it up. We'll post our slides and recording, and we'll also put a link to the post of the CIHR presentation from yesterday as well when we get it from them. There were also presentations from CMHC and Stats Canada on some of the data sets available there to use. So. I thank you, Danny, very much for presenting, and as well as everyone who's attended. And we look forward to working with you, and best of luck on successful grant applications. All right.
Great. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.